Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 27 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Widzik. This episode is with my good friend, Max Cole Takanikos. He is an actor and a visual artist, and the current show I'm directing, The Pillow Man, I am utilizing both of his talents. So he is playing the lead role of Katurian, but he's also illustrating the stories that Katurian writes, and he did this really cool process of taking black and white stills, and then he is illustrating over them, and they look amazing! The Pillow Man opens July 10th, and then runs through the 25th. I'll have all the information where you can get tickets and all that in the episode description. This episode is sponsored by KLMXYZ Creative Communications. Visit klmxyz.com. You can see samples of Catherine Lynn Morgan's work. She does posters, postcards, reformatting of resume, also book design. Anyway, she's stellar, and you should check her out and use her for all of your marketing and design needs. Without further ado, please enjoy episode 27 with Max Cole Takanikos. I'm here with my really good friend, Max Cole Takanikos. Welcome to the podcast, Max.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here.
We've known each other almost 8 years.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy. If I'm not mistaken, I am one of the first people that you met when you came to Whidbey Island.
This is true. I went to see a production of Orphans at Whidbey Children's Theater, and it was Ken Church, Dave Janak, and Ed Cornaccio. And Susie Richards said, you gotta meet Max. He's a theater guy like you.
Yeah.
And well, I met you, and how old were you 8 years ago?
Oh, gosh. 16.
You were 16, and I was 20. I had just turned 22.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Crazy. How different we were.
We're like grown-ups now. What the hell,
We are like grown-ups, yes.
We're like grown-ups.
We bear a resemblance to what is generally thought of as a grown-up,
perhaps. It's true. We're here in your apartment, which is kind of like a really awesome Portlandia museum, I think.
Okay.
I mean that in like the best way.
Yes.
There's a lot of art, and a lot of the art you created. Is this true?
Yes, it is true. I'm too much of a cheapskate to spend any money on real art. Too much of a cheapskate to actually support other artists, so my walls are festooned with my own ego. Just kidding.
That's a fantastic sentence, though. Like, what if you were serious about that?
My walls are festooned with my own ego.
Yeah, I like that.
All right.
I'm going to write that in a play sometime. We wrote a play together.
We did.
It was called Chemistry, and we've done it twice. So we collaborate often. I think we should start with, let's go through, like, production by production that we've worked on. How does that sound?
Gosh. That sounds great. That sounds great. This is going to be a journey through time.
It's like imagine when we're talking about each show that this is like the DVD color commentary, like the director's cut that we're putting over like scenes of each show, although there's not going to be a visual component about this at all.
So we really have to paint
a
picture with
words. We're
asking
the listeners to use their imagination.
Right.
Which I
believe they will be able to do.
It's pretty classy crowd who listens to this podcast.
I'm sure a bunch of gentlemen and gentle women.
And non-binary folks as well. We want to include everyone.
Robots, speaking of binary.
Cats.
Cats, dogs.
Aliens.
Fish people.
I like how we said aliens and fish people at the same time.
That's just kind of where
our
minds went.
That's where our minds go because we're awesome.
Mer people.
Mm-hmm. Mer people.
Because you don't want to.
Especially the mer people. You don't want to piss them off.
No.
So the first show we worked on together was The Good Doctor.
Yeah, it was,
wasn't
it? At
Whidbey Island Center for the Arts. We didn't have a scene together, but
no.
We were in the same show. You were in a scene in which your father, played by your father, Barton, bought you a night with a prostitute.
Right, yeah. This is supposedly somewhat autobiographical for Chekhov.
The Good Doctor is based on, it's written by Neil Simon, it's based on the life and stories of Anton Chekhov.
Right, so supposedly, his father decided when his son was 19, I think, when Chekhov was 19, yeah, that it was time for him to become a man, and so he took him down to the docks and decided to hire him a prostitute. And apparently, though, I've heard that in real life, Chekhov's dad was kind of a sort of a weakling.
So maybe that's not true.
Maybe it's not true. But anyway, it was a very interesting experience to share with my own father.
Had you acted with him before?
I had. We had appeared on stage before.
A Thousand Clowns?
No, not A Thousand Clowns. It might have been just Weepy Children's Theater stuff.
Sure.
When I was a wee tot.
When you were a wee tot.
But, yeah, it was great. You know, people still, every now and then, say, "Hey, I love that scene you did with your dad."
I have to give a shout out to, but I don't know if Martin's going to listen to this or not, but if people are wondering about the title of this podcast, which is the Theatrical Mustang Podcast, do you know this? I don't know if you know this.
Yes, I do know this.
Based off of a compliment your father did not give directly to me, but gave to Gina Simpson, who's Aaron's mom, that he said, "Oh, that Katie Woodzik, she's a theatrical Mustang of sorts," which...
Well,
still wins best compliment in my book.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so I'm like, I'm going to do something with that someday.
And it's perfectly fitting for you and for the podcast as well, I think.
Thanks, Max.
No, oh, you're welcome, Katie.
I know, I'm so bad at taking a compliment, especially like on air.
Right, you have to put on that weird ironic voice.
Yeah. That's need to be better about taking compliments.
We do.
So, Good Doctor, right? That was 2008?
That was 2007, I think. Because...
I graduated in 2007.
I think it was 2007.
I think it was 2008. We'll check the records
sure?
afterwards.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
All right.
And I think the next one we did together was Sweeney Todd.
Yes. That was a fun show.
Sweeney Todd, and you played Anthony. Mm. And I played a dude.
You did?
I played Pirelli, the barber. Following in the footsteps of Sacha Baron Cohen.
Right. You were the most beautiful Italian man I think ever laid eyes upon.
Thank you. Yes. A lot of ace rap was involved in the construction of that character. Mm. And Jimmy Scullin was in that. He played the Beetle Bamford. Bamford, yeah.
Snapping heads off of birds and
yeah.
whatnot.
Yeah, man.
So we have seen the gentle and kind Jimmy be a complete and utter dick before.
This is true. We were recording a video blog before this, and we were talking about how on the current show we're working on, which is The Pillow Man, both Ned Farley and Jimmy Scullin play these kind of hard asses,
yeah.
these really aggressive detectives, and it couldn't be further from how they are in real life.
Yeah, they're just terrifying on stage, but then the minute the action stops, they're apologizing to me and...
Okay?
Are you okay?
You okay?
You know, it's very gentle.
Because you're very good at taking a punch or being tortured.
And making it too real.
I worry about you sometimes. Sometimes I'm like, do I have to stop the rehearsal?
Well, that
no,
would be.
He looks okay.
It means I'm doing my job.
I trust that you're going to say something if you're actually in pain.
I would.
That's good. So, and Sweeney Todd, one of my favorite stories, is that the cart that I was in, Pirelli's barber cart, we had a pyrotechnic effect on the top of it, and it would catch on fire about every other night.
Right.
And so I could not wait to get the hell out of that contraption. And then Jimmy would have a wet towel that he would wrap around his cane, and he would surreptitiously climb up on the back of the cart and put the fire out whenever it happened.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Anything that can go wrong will go wrong. Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law. But what about Murphy Brown? He shrugged. He shrugged.
I shrugged.
This is an audio medium, Max.
I'm sorry. It's okay. I'm a visually minded being.
This is true. Next up, I think is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern next.
Yeah, those were in the same year.
Yeah.
Sweeney Todd and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Same season.
Same season. Right. Not the same. Same school year because I was in high school. So
you
that's where my mind is.
Oh my gosh, you're so young.
I was just a wee babe.
You were just a wee babe. And you played Rosencrantz.
Rosencrantz.
Yes, I got it right.
Yes.
I directed that. I should know that. That's sort of shameful.
How dare you?
But I was so proud of that show. I loved that show.
It was a lot of fun.
We had... That was a great cast, and it was... my first time directing a show out here and at Wicca, so in a bigger venue. We had original music for that, too. We worked with Ian Marciani and Robert Marciani, and they were doing cool things with pennies and the piano strings.
They're quite talented.
We're just reveling, taking a moment to revel in how talented Ian and Robert Marciani are.
Yes.
I'm trying to... Is Wind in the Willows next?
Wind in the Willows would be next, I believe, yes.
I think it was the following fall that we did that, and you played Toad.
Right, and I was your only scene partner, was I not?
This is correct, yeah. I played four parts. I played the washerwoman and the judge and the train conductor and a thief with a very bad accent.
Yes.
It was a very bad accent.
Well, you were the human component.
I was. Everyone else was animals. And I remember the angriest I've ever seen you is when I accidentally hit you on the head with a spoon.
Yeah. You hit me quite hard on the head with that spoon. That really hurt.
It just whacked.
And I did say something.
Yeah.
I was pissed. I think that's the only time that I've been actually mad at you. I think.
Well, with good reason.
Yeah.
Because I smacked you on the head with a spoon. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's in the past.
Okay.
I forgive you.
I accept your apology. What's after Wind in the Willows?
Gosh,
I'm the interviewer. I should know these things. I should have taken notes. No, there's more stuff. I think after Wind in the Willows is when we wrote Chemistry.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of where that falls into the timeline. And then I think the next show we did together was Why Torture is Wrong and the People Who Love Them.
Yes.
Because we were both doing acting, but sort of had parallel paths that weren't intersecting at that time. And then we had Christopher Durang, who's a playwright I love, our friend Ned, who's in the show, in the Pillowman acting, was directing that show. And we were having, as you do, a hard time finding an ethnically ambiguous young man to play the part of Zamir, the possible terrorist. And you are such a good friend, because I remember texting you and saying, the read-through is tomorrow.
Yeah.
We don't have anyone. Will you just come just for the read-through?
And I did. I was there.
And you did. And I'm like, if he reads it out loud, then maybe he'll fall in love with it. Maybe he'll actually do it. That was my secret.
And I did.
And you did.
And I loved the script so much that I had to be part of it.
I love that moment afterwards when you and Ned had this... It was a very non-dramatic moment where Ned was like, I kind of want to cast you in that part. And you're like, I kind of want to do it. And that was it. Done.
That was it. Yeah. That was the most casually
casted
way that I was casted, I think, in any show I've ever been in.
And that show was a lot of... So I guess in July, this is the second year where you just get beat up a lot in a play.
Right, yeah. Well, and I haven't done any shows in between the two, so this is becoming a bit of a habit for
me. We'll have to have something cool next year to work on.
Right, yeah.
We shall see.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about... That sounded very Canadian.
Let's talk about it, shall we?
Let's talk about it. So you were kind of a shy kid growing up, right?
I was quite shy, yeah. When I was very young, I was, I would say, almost cripplingly shy. I would hide behind my parents' legs in public situations. And a lot of my parents' friends actually almost got their feelings hurt a little bit. They were like, does Max not like us? Because
Aww.
He just clams up. Yeah, the only people I was really open around were my parents and then the few close friends that I had.
Why do you... Because you're the son of... Your parents are both performers. Your mother...
Right, they're very outgoing, both of them.
What the hell happened, man?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think maybe I was a doorstep baby, you know? Maybe they found me. Maybe I was in a little basket a la Harry Potter.
Okay.
With a little note that read, here's a really shy baby. I don't want to deal with it. So...
Have fun.
Enjoy. But yeah, I'm not sure. And I think that I've certainly, to coin a phrase, come out of my shell somewhat since then. And I think that's due mostly to the fact that my parents never really tried to force me to you know, to be more social and whatnot. They kind of just let it run its course.
Oh, that's great.
And I emerged from the chrysalis as a, you know, a young man that could actually handle himself in social scenarios, for the most part.
Do you remember the first show you did as a kid?
I do, yeah. It was Tom Sawyer with Whidbey Children's Theater when I was 7 years old. And I really was not wanting to do it at first, because this is back when I was very shy. And my mother kind of just convinced me that it would be a lot of fun. And I went, and I was very intimidated because there were all these other kids around that I didn't know. But I had a lot of fun. And it was directed by Martha Murphy, the legend. And she really helped me, you know, kind of open up, too, around other kids my age.
What part did you play?
I had a bit part. I was one of Tom's friends.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's this one scene where someone flubbed a line, and I made my entrance too early because this line was my cue to enter.
Oh.
And I step out on stage, and none of the other kids that were supposed to be coming out with me did, because they were much smarter than I was. And I think I ad-libbed something about, well, I'm going to go hunt some more crawdads now. And I stepped off stage, and that was my birth as an actor, perhaps.
Improvising.
Right. Talking about fishing crawdads.
What other shows did you do pre-meeting me?
Pre-meeting you.
Yeah.
I did Huckleberry Finn as well. And I played the Duke. The Duke.
Oh!
That was actually my first...
That's a juicy part.
That was my first juicy part that I ever had.
How old were you then?
I was about 12.
Okay.
Maybe 11. 11 or 12. Yeah, but that was a lot of fun. And I had that song, the theater, you know? In the theater. And man, I hated that. Because I was really not confident in my singing voice. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
What came after Huckleberry Finn?
I did some stuff with the Third Street Players, which was of the older, you know, sort of the high school-aged sect of Whidbey Children's Theater. I did Play On.
I saw that.
That was a lot of fun. And
it's a ridiculous show.
It is a very ridiculous show. I'd like to have the opportunity to do it again at some point, maybe a few years down the road, you know, to really fully realize that. I did Treasure Island, played Long John Silver.
No, I didn't see you in that, but I saw Andy Walker do it when they did it the second time around.
Right, right.
And your dad helped to rig a peg leg?
Yeah, we made well, see, the thing is, actually, it's a bit of a misunderstanding that Long John Silver doesn't actually have a peg leg in the books.
Oh.
He uses a crutch, and he's just got a leg missing.
Uh-huh.
So what we did was we rigged up this really elaborate thing with like a sling that went over my shoulder.
Oh my gosh.
And a belt around my waist with a sort of a pouch
that
my foot would go in. my foot is basically just up against my ass in this pouch. So it's being pressed sideways.
Sure.
along my ass, and then there's another I keep saying the word ass. I'm sorry.
ass, it's fine.
Ass. And then there's another strap that's going around my bent leg to hold it in position.
Painful, right?
You know, it wasn't that bad. It cramped quite a bit when I would take the sling off.
Okay.
But it was very effective, and I had a crutch that I made myself from a piece of driftwood that I found. It was perfectly crutch shaped. The funny thing was, though, Andy Walker and I and Gabe Harshman, who was in that show as well, played we were sort of the principal characters, so we had our own dressing room, and it was kind of a section of the green room was kind of cordoned off with these flats, and there was one flat that sort of just had a rectangular hole cut in it, but it, you know, in lieu of like an actual doorway, but the hole didn't go all the way down to the ground, so there's this thing you have to step over, and I of course have one leg So I'm needing to get in and out of the dressing room, and I kind of have to sort of crouch down and, like, go and, you know, hoist myself and hop on one foot over the thing. And I think I fell down a handful of times, but it was great. It was great fun. There was one part where I had an exit on stage left and then an entrance on stage right almost immediately after that.
Yikes.
And I don't know why it turned out that way, but... So, of course, you know, my mobility is challenged, so I can't get over there fast enough. So I get backstage and I sit in like a wheelie office chair, and I have, you know, a bunch of these charming little kids that are part of the cast wheel me.
Seriously?
All the way through the hallways, past the office and everything, through the lobby and to the other side of the stage so I can make my entrance. And I think that's one of my fondest memories from that, you know, just... I get to go and have this thrill ride on this office chair with one leg sitting on my own foot.
Building community.
Yeah.
What's the solution? We have to fix this problem.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Creative problem solving.
Creative problem solving.
What other... I'm trying to remember, but I wasn't here, so I probably...
Right.
We did some stuff with Island Shakespeare Festival.
I did, yeah. Yeah, I was involved the first 2 years of that in As You Like It and Romeo and Juliet. And that was great because I'd never had an opportunity before that to do any Shakespeare, apart from, you know, a little bit in school and whatnot. And yeah, so that was great fun. The first year we had kind of this sort of post-apocalypse theme, like Mad Max, you know, Beyond the Thunderdome. So everyone had, you know, leather and big hefty boots on and whatnot. So that was quite fun. And that space. On the Chinook land in the middle of the forest.
Wow.
Really lovely.
Really beautiful, yeah.
Yeah.
There was something else that came into my head after I said Shakespeare. Oh, Chekhov, you were in Three Sisters, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, yeah, that was around when I was, I think, 16 as well. And that was, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
What role did you play?
I played Captain Solioni. Who's, for those of you that are unfamiliar with the piece, he's this just real asshole. he's kind of, I guess you would say, the antagonist of the show. But he's, you know, he's a bit younger than the rest, and yet he's achieved this captaincy. So I think he's the second most high-ranking officer in the Russian army in the show. And, he's just very, very button pushing and, you know, just manipulative. And, there's a section of the play where he nearly rapes the youngest of the sisters.
Wow.
And that was really a challenge for me as a, you know, a boy playing this role.
Right.
It was really tough. Cause it was just kind of a sickening scene. But it was interesting to have the opportunity to get inside the head of someone just with, you know, not necessarily any motive that's easy to see, but they're just kind of just bad.
Yeah.
And yet maybe also, you know, their badness comes from a lot of insecurity and vulnerability, sort of, that they you know, try to guard. But that was a really fun show. Yeah, and it was kind of too bad because I think that a lot of people, not as many people saw it as I would have hoped, because it's really just, it's a dark show, you know.
Right.
Like, there's an uplifting moment at the end, but for the most part, it's just, you know, it's Chekhov. And it's just so Russian, you know.
That's so Russian. So That's So Raven?
That's So Russian.
That's So Russian.
Yeah. But that was a fun opportunity to have. That was great.
And this, prior to Torture, you had done one show with Outkast. You had done Oh, What a Lovely War.
Yes.
You were kind of the narrator character.
Right. I was sort of the MC, which was fun because from the start, Sandy O'Brien, who, you know, directed, she told me that I could kind of sort of have free reign to mess with, you know, the audience.
You messed with me the night I came.
I did mess with you. Yeah, so that was a really fun show to do because, you know, obviously it's a structured script, but I had a little bit of leeway to kind of just be kind of a free agent, whereas everyone else is sort of tied into their particular roles and blocking and whatnot. And I, you know, for the most part, I was relatively consistent. But yeah, that was fun because usually when I'm in a show, I try to keep my performance as consistent as possible for the sake of my scene partners and whatnot.
Right. You know.
And I know that some people think that you should try to throw people for a loop a little bit just to keep it fresh and organic. But I've always felt like, you know, if once you figure out something that works really well, then you should kind of stick with it. But that was a cool opportunity to kind of step outside of my comfort zone in that respect.
And your cat is gracing us with her presence,
yes,
right now.
My cat, her name's Moose Jaw.
Hi, Moose. You want to meow so we can hear you on the podcast?
Would you like to say hello, Moose? No.
You're being very feline right now.
She is. She's just checking everything out. A lot of new smells.
Smelling my purse right now. This is exciting. Doing a play-by-play of a cat. The cat sees.
Yes, right. Hey, well, cat media.
Oh, yeah. You want to talk? That's funny. So Vito Zingarelli, who's been on the podcast, who I have the pleasure of working with, he sent out an article to all the staff members last week that the University of Indiana, I believe, has just completed this extensive study that shows that consuming cat media online is actually good for you and, like, combats depression and anxiety and makes you more productive. And
right.
So watch some cat videos after this, people, for God's sakes.
Call your therapist, give them the bad news. And
then they're fired because you're just going
right,
to watch cat stuff?
Because you don't need to go to therapy. You can just sit at home and watch videos of cats, which is great.
It's a revolution, actually.
I mean, I know a lot of people already do that routinely. It's just
you could do both.
You could.
It could be like supplementary therapeutic activity.
Well, and perhaps this is an opportunity for a new type of therapeutic profession where basically you have someone come into your office and you just show them images and videos of cats until they feel better.
That could be a travel. I smell a TV show, Cat Therapist.
Mm. that makes me think of a cat laying on a couch saying, well, I had several siblings when I was young, and I could never quite get to the teat because there were so many of us, and it was quite hard.
I think that's the first time the word teat has been used on this podcast.
Oh, well.
I'm almost positive that that's the case.
I'm glad to have been the first to use it then. Teat. It's a good word.
So I want to, because I want to get to talking about Pillow Man, but I want to sort of track your trajectory as a visual artist as well, because I think one of the things that excites me most about the show is that it's this really awesome intersection of your visual art and your work as an actor. And so, have you always been drawing things since
yeah.
you were a little kid, or where did that
basically,
come from?
Yeah, that was sort of the first, you know, artistic media that I picked up was messing around with watercolors and you know, pencils and pens and whatnot. There's just a slew of old, you know, childhood photographs of me crouched down on the floor, you know, sort of hunched over a little piece of paper, and I would get really close to the paper, and I think that might have been because my parents didn't yet know that I had horrible eyesight, but maybe also just because I was very, very focused and sort of in my own world that I was creating through my drawings. But yeah, I pretty much just started when I was very young and never stopped.
Did you take classes in your schooling?
I didn't have any classes when I was very young, apart from just, you know, the normal, like, let's cut out pieces of construction paper and make them look like Santa Claus.
Right.
And whatnot. But then when I got into high school, I focused a lot of my electives on art classes, which was really great. And I did an independent study as well, which was a lot of fun because I could basically just take my easel in, and it was essentially a free period where I could just paint and draw. And yeah, but I've never really had any formal training, which I think that I think can be very useful, but I don't think in this day and age is really as important as it used to be. And it's interesting because you look at guys like Picasso and whatnot, who started doing stuff that nobody else had ever thought of before, but they were still classically trained in, you know, classical portraiture and whatnot.
Right.
And I think that part of the reason they were able to do what they did was because they had that initial training. And so part of me wonders what types of things I would discover if I were to receive formal artistic training. But for the time being, you know, I think I'm just having fun.
What media do you like to work in?
Pen and ink, mostly, I think is my favorite. Partially because it's really easy just to carry around a notebook and a couple of pens. And, you know, just draw whatever comes to my mind in the moment. And so I think that because of that, that's probably the medium that I've got the most experience with. And it's just really fun to figure out different ways of getting the right shade you want with exclusively just black ink, like doing cross-hatching and whatnot. And I really love, there's an old comic called The Spirit, which I know that, you know, some people are familiar with, but mostly probably because of the movie that was made several years ago, which I didn't really see, but I heard it wasn't that great. But this old comic by Will Eisner, I think it's from the 30s and 40s, but he's the spirit is this like resurrected policeman who goes around, you know,
oh, right.
Works with the police force solving crimes and whatnot. And it's really great because Will Eisner, the artist, used so much ink. His stuff is just really, really dark, and there's a heavy contrast between light and dark, which I think influenced me a lot. My dad had a lot of old spirit comics that he gave me when I was a kid, so I spent a lot of time looking through them, and so I think that's his style is definitely a style that I aspire toward. But pen and ink definitely is my favorite.
What other artists inspire you? What aesthetics are you drawn to?
Well, for a long time, I really was, you know, really admired Banksy, the graffiti artist, quite a bit.
Sure.
Kind of when he was first really getting on the scene and everyone was picking up on his stuff. Because he kind of has the same sort of heavy contrast, you know, really stark stuff. And just sort of the messages that he seemed to be sending out, sort of just, you know, messing with society and the ways people viewed certain things and whatnot. Like there was the one of two like, you know, royal guards, you know, with the big fuzzy hats,
right.
Making out with each other.
Yeah.
That he put on a street corner in London. And I just love that kind of thing, you know, because it's like he just wasn't really taking anything seriously at all. It was sort of a middle finger to the whole stuffy British, you know, upper crust kind of thing. And so I think that he was a big influence on me. Another one is MC Escher.
Yeah.
His stuff is just, I mean, that was another one that I was really into when I was a kid, and his stuff just blew my mind. The realism of it and the surrealism as well, and how he messed with geometry. And just really, really stunning. So I think that those are a few of my biggest influences. And it's funny because they all, you know, most of them work mostly in black and white, which I really feel drawn to. Especially also if you add a dash of one particular color in there.
Sure.
It can have such a strong impact. Yeah. Yeah, it's great. That's mostly what I do. I've been carrying around lately a black pen and a red pen as well.
I love that color combination.
Black, white, and red. You can't go wrong. That's the Amsterdam flag, actually.
Is it?
Yeah, it's great.
Amsterdam.
It's a nice looking flag.
So in The Pillow Man, which is the show we're working on right now, written by Martin McDonagh, there are these scenes, which are long monologues, where you, as the character of Couturian, the writer who's written over 400 short stories, read your stories out loud, tell them to the audience, and the way that the play is written, it's supposed to be acted out by other actors, but I made the choice as the director to come to you and ask you if you'd be willing to illustrate those scenes instead, because you're a visual artist as well as an actor. And so can you talk a little bit about what, I know that last night we captured images, which you're going to then work with and draw over and whatnot, but what was your process in sort of designing the look of these projections?
Well, for one, the play is very stark. And I think that, you know, speaking of the kind of contrast between light and dark, I think that's sort of a concept that is really explored in the show. At least, you know, for me, that's kind of one thing that I take away from it. And it takes place in a totalitarian state. So I was kind of, the first thing that I saw in my mind was these really sort of stark photographic images in black and white, with really, you know, really high contrast lighting and everything. Sort of like when you picture, almost kind of like if you imagine a massive party that devolves into something just totally, you know, just complete debauchery.
Right.
And when you imagine if there's a photographer on the scene, it's nighttime, taking just, you know, black and white photos with flash on of just these crazy things happening, you know. I don't think I know enough about, you know, the photography scene to really cite a particular influence, but I know I've seen that kind of thing before. Like a lot of, it sort of makes me think of like, you know, Los Angeles photography. I don't really know what that means, but anyway. So I pictured, you know, these photos of, there are these crazy things that happen to be going on in the night, and I happen to be there with a camera to capture it. And so these things that are depicted in these stories, I'll take a photograph of that. And then what I'm going to do is I'll put them into a sketching program that I have. So I'll basically draw on the details of the scene over the photo itself in a very stylistic way. Probably mostly in red, you know, keeping with the whole, my whole black, white, red obsession. And, I think that's also, you know, it really fits because there's a lot of blood in this particular play.
This is true.
So it'll be sort of just the suggestion of details of the scene, of, you know, particular props and, defining facial characteristics and whatnot. Because I had you and Aaron Simpson, who's also in the show, and my girlfriend Natasha wearing these white masks. We just did this last night, shot these photos.
And at the time of this recording.
At the time of this recording, right? Gotta clarify that. We went around and, you know, walked around town and just shot these photos, and it was very just loose and free form, and
it was so great.
I think it was a lot of fun.
It's kind of like a silent, but it was a bit of an improvisation.
It was sort of.
And yeah, you sort of go. I mean, I was reminded a little bit about, I don't know if it's Commedia dell'arte, but you know there are schools of acting where you do a lot of mask work, mm-hmm. right? And it's about, you know, being embodied and the power of gesture, because right. you can't. Your face isn't really doing that much. And right. so the angle of your head or the way that you're holding your hands or whatever really informs the emotional content of the image.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I almost forgot to mention that was a heavy influence on this particular idea was the film of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Oh.
Where the players, when they're performing the show for,
Claudius.
For Claudius, and, you know, he gets all freaked out and whatnot. they've got these masks on that are just really, you know, expressionless and almost kind of alien looking a little bit. Like the bridge of the nose is really like bizarrely wide,
right.
kind of, and they're just these pale, like rubber masks, and they've all got them on, and it's, I mean, when you see, you know, when you see Hamlet's dad getting poisoned and dying basically with this mask on, and he's just quivering, and it was really, you know, it sends kind of a chill through your spine.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was definitely an influence on the idea to have masks on, particularly also because then it'll make it that much easier to superimpose
features
over the top of just that white kind of eerie look.
Shivers.
Yeah.
I can't wait. I'm really excited to see how it all turns out. I went to Ashley Erickson, who's a local composer, and she's created this incredible score for the monologues. Mm. Did you, when you're going to be, you know, working with these images, are you letting that inform you at all, the music, or is it just sort of...
A bit, yeah. I think, you know, for the most part, when I came up with this idea for the photos was before I'd heard any of the music.
Right.
But I think it was really helpful to have it in mind as I was taking the pictures, because it's so, you know, it's really just melancholic and, yeah,
a lot of minor stuff.
Yeah, I think it really helped set the tone for the photos as well. Yeah, it's just really lovely music. And it's so cool to get the opportunity to have, an original score. And it's just great to be able to collaborate artistically like that, you know, with the original artistic pieces and original music. And it's so great to get the opportunity to contribute visually to the show as well as acting in it. It's just so cool. I've never really gotten an opportunity to do that before, so.
Well, no pressure.
Well, you know.
Let's talk about your character, Katorian.
Yes, let's talk about...
Which you find out his name is actually Katorian, Katorian, Katorian.
Right. Because his parents were funny people.
And I love Topolsky's line, read for funny people, stupid fucking assholes, I think is what
yeah,
he says,
stupid,
right?
Stupid fucking idiots.
Idiots, right. Yeah. Idiots, not assholes. Thank you.
Same diff.
Thank you for the correction. Talk about your character and what goes into you. How do you approach building a character?
Yeah, it's, Katorian is a really, Katorian.
You have to say all three of them.
He's a really interesting character, because, you know, without, you know, trying not to give too much away, he's got this really dark and troubled past where he's had to have just absolute resolve in the things that he's had to do. And I think that he's, you know, he's sort of gotten to a point where life is definitely informed by the darkness of the past, but it's relatively comfortable. You know, he's got a job that he doesn't necessarily enjoy, but also doesn't detest. And then he's got his writing. And I think that obviously he identifies himself as a writer before anything else. And so I think there's, in a way, he sort of takes himself quite seriously in that respect, as, you know, I think certain writers, you know, could be want to do. But he's just an interesting character to have gotten to know a little bit without, you know, trying not to sound too crafty about it. But yeah, sort of, I don't really have necessarily a formula for developing a character or anything like that. I know that some people like to keep like a notebook specifically and write down their entire backstory and whatnot. And I've found that that's been particularly helpful for some roles, and for others, not particularly necessary. But I think when I feel like a role really resonates with me, then that stuff kind of occurs naturally.
Sure.
In the rehearsal process and when you're reading the script and memorizing your lines, I think that certain details about that character's life become obvious to you because you can really see why they're motivated to say particular things or to do particular actions and behave the way they're behaving. And I think that's largely the case with Katorian. And I think that, you know, I feel like there's always, for me, there's a certain degree of myself in every role that I play, because I think that it's too, I mean, I have a lot of admiration for actors that are able to completely disappear within a role. Daniel Day-Lewis is one of my favorite actors, and I know that he notoriously doesn't get out of character when he's on set at all.
It's true.
Which is just, you know, it's amazing, and that's what works for him. But for me, it's always nice to find which ways I'm similar to the character that I'm playing and use those kind of as tools and strengths almost. And I think that, you know, despite Couturier's dark, troubled past, and, you know, my life has been relatively easy in the grand scheme of things, I think I see a lot of similarities between him and myself. And particularly the, you know, having your identity as sort of an artist, you know, and really being passionately devoted to that. And even just to thinking of yourself as that, because that's probably half the battle in a way. I could go on for a while, but
I'm just smiling because it's, you know, as a director, you don't always get insight into your actor's process. But can you talk a little bit about your castmates and what it's like to work with each of them?
Yeah. Well, the bulk of my stage time is spent with Ned and Jimmy, and I mean, like I've already mentioned, their characters are terrifying, especially initially from the start.
Right.
You know, they're just putting Couturier absolutely through the ringer and, you know, fucking with him physically and emotionally and verbally. And it's truly to be on stage with them. As an actor, I feel very safe, which is obviously extremely important, but as the character, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. And yeah, it's really great also because Couturier also has moments with each of them that are, you know, where they kind of are sort of almost acknowledging, like, you know, I'm a human being too, as well as you. And we're just, this is the situation that we happen to find ourselves in, where I am a detective and I'm interrogating you, and you're a writer and you're being interrogated by me. And it almost seems like if things were just slightly changed, it could have just as easily have been the other way, almost,
right.
You know? And it's great because these two guys just are these intimidating forces at first and through the bulk of the show. But there are brief moments where you get to see inside their heads a little bit, which I really enjoy. And they're both just absolute gentlemen and really fun to work with. And they really energize me on stage. You know, they make my job just that much easier to be in character and to feel all the proper emotions at the proper times and whatnot. And then Aaron, playing my brother Michael, is just really great because there's such tenderness between them that I think you know you would often find between two brothers that don't hate each other's guts, because I know that happens sometimes too, particularly when they're so close in age. His character is 1 year older than mine, but I think it's great, especially physically, Couturier's relationship with Michael, because you get to see how Couturier looks after him and how really sweet they are with one another, particularly at first. And I think the role of Michael might even be perhaps the most challenging in the show.
It's true.
Because, you know, he's got this, you know, mental challenge, a little bit of brain damage. And I think it would be, I would imagine it would be really hard to play that without being, you know, offensive or overdoing it or underdoing it. And I think that, you know, it's been great to see Aaron's process into becoming, you know, getting straight to the spot where he needs to be with that character.
He interviewed a psychiatrist, I believe, about victims of childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just see
Yeah.
Since he's fairly new to acting, mm-hmm. It's been, I think it can be intimidating coming into a show where everyone else has a lot more experience than you do.
Right, yeah.
And so I can, I just have so much respect for him really stepping up and...
Yeah, that's great.
Doing all that character work outside of the rehearsal hall.
Well, and I think that's so much fun too, when you get an opportunity to play a role where it really necessitates a lot of research, you know?
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of background work, and I just think that's great that he's doing that. I mean, that's so much fun to be able to figure out how that character would exist in the real world and bring that to the stage.
What's it like to, cause you've known Aaron since you guys were kids, like,
yeah,
for over 25 years, would you say?
Well, no. You know, I haven't been alive for 25 years.
Oh, well.
Unfortunately.
Fine. The math doesn't add up.
I can't rent a car yet. But,
over 20 years. Over 20 years, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we've known each other for quite a long time. And we were not necessarily very close when we were young at all. Because, you know, he was older than me. And I think there was that kind of gap. I was very good friends with his younger brother, who is my age. And so I think that Aaron was always kind of like, you know, he was Nathan's older brother. And
right.
That's all he ever was. Yeah, but I feel like in recent years, Aaron and I have gotten to look at each other more as peers. And we have become a lot closer than we ever were. And it's just great because I already, you know, would have, I think I would say I've started to feel kind of a brotherly bond toward him. Particularly
sure.
Because we've known each other for such a long time. And even not necessarily having been close, but even when you have known someone for a long time, maybe even if your paths have only crossed a few times, there's a certain, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but there's a certain closeness you can feel to them without really being close.
Sure.
But yeah, so it's great to get an opportunity to explore the relationship of two brothers, you know, one brother really caring for the other one and looking after him. Particularly because, you know, I don't have any brothers. And I had wondered what it would be like to have one. And at times wished, you know, I wish I had a brother.
Right.
Like a, you know, a younger brother that I could really impress upon to become just the coolest dude he could be, you know. I think that would have been fun. So, yeah, so it's kind of fun to get to explore that relationship. Because I think that the relationship between two brothers is entirely unique,
right,
from all other relationships, just like the relationship between two sisters or a brother and a sister. So that's been a lot of fun. Yeah, I just feel very honored to get to work with this cast. I feel like it's kind of a dream
fucking team. Cast. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where they say directing is what, 85% casting, and everyone's just been showing up and so dedicated and I think part of that is just the script is so good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Martin McDonagh, he's also written in Bruges, Seven Psychopaths. He won the Academy Award for Six Shooter. And so he writes for both cinema and the stage. And he's just freaking brilliant. You know, like I'm a feminist. I'm a big supporter of female playwrights. And I try to choose projects to direct and act in that have female playwrights attached to them, but I just couldn't pass this one up. People ask me why I chose this piece, and it's simply, when I read it in college, it was one of the best plays I had ever read, and I just had two thoughts after I read it. The first was, I can't believe I've read something that exists like this, that has affected me so much on an emotional level just by reading it on the page, not by watching it or reading it out loud, just that solitary activity of reading that on the page. And then the second thought was, I have to direct this. And that was like eight or nine years ago. And so this has been a long time coming, and I'm just grateful to Outcast and grateful to the cast that it's happening soon. So, we're going to have all the information in the episode description about dates. The dates are July 10th through the 25th. You're going to want to get tickets because It is a small black box space that sells out quickly. And the show's going to be good, so it is going to sell out.
Oh, yes.
People are already excited and chatting, and there's a buzz. There's a good buzz going around.
I feel like,
not a disclaimer, but, I mean, the posters do say mature content, and it's, I mean, as we were sort of saying before when we were doing the vlog, I mean, it's sort of in terms of the intensity and violence and language, like, if you like Dexter, or Law & Order SVU, or Walking Dead, those are the sort of intense, darkly... But all those things have moments of humor, too. I mean,
true.
I especially think of Dexter,
true.
Where these horrible things are happening, but you're viewing it through a lens of humor. Mm. And so, but I kind of feel like the responsibility to tell people about...
Yeah, I think it would be tough for some people to watch. And as just ludicrously excited as I am for this show, it's interesting having to be sort of selective as far as the people that I encourage to come see it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know that my mother is going to see it to support me, but it's going to be quite hard for her to see me getting smacked around and whatnot.
Yeah.
Especially because she had to go through that
a year ago
with Why Torture
with
Is
a
Wrong.
A more humorous piece.
Right, right. But, yeah.
You don't wear a ball gag in your mouth this time,
thankfully,
so.
I don't. Right. Thankfully, I don't.
Well, I like to sort of end each episode by asking... I have two more questions for you, and one of them is just what advice would you give to actors or visual artists? Like, what's your sort of like go-to advice for creatives?
Advice. That's funny. I usually find that I'm on the
receiving end of advice.
Yeah. I would say that one of the most important things with any type of art is just to be completely fearless. And I think that that's something that I'm certainly still working on myself, because I think it's much easier said than done.
Right.
But just do what you want to do. And, you know, and I think that find whatever motivation it is that's going to keep you at it. And just, you know, don't be afraid to proudly share what you have to offer with the rest of the world. And do it every day and never stop doing it. I think that's the most important
thing. That's great advice, Max.
Well, hey, you know, I can pull something out of the hat when I need to.
And then the other question I like to ask actors is, what's on your bucket list? What roles are, it's going to happen for sure.
Well, I know it's cliche, but, Hamlet.
Yeah.
I think is just, that's the one, that's the dream. Because that character has such an epic roller coaster of arcs and ups and downs and sidewayses, that I just think it would be amazing to get an opportunity to play that role that so many other people have brought their own unique things to. And just, I don't know, it'd be really an honor to get a chance to contribute whatever I would come up with to contribute to the kind of
legacy.
The sort of like, you know, yeah, the legacy that is that particular role. Kind of this amorphous sort of celestial figure that all these different actors have contributed to that is Hamlet, you know, this immortal play and this immortal character. That's I think my biggest one. Other than that, you know, for someone that occasionally does theater, I'm not really that much of a theater buff. So
it's true.
It's hard to come up with a good.
I think Hamlet's a good answer. And then another question. I know I said I have one more question, and then it's become three questions.
Oh,
but could we end the interview with a couple of your impressions? Because you have a very uncanny ear.
Sure. Yeah.
And so maybe just close us out with a couple of your impressions.
Well, let's see. First, I think I'll do Sean Connery. let's see here. Miss Moneypenny. I'm James Bond. I'm going to go. I've got a license to kill. And did you know, actually, that for all of his performances as James Bond, Sean Connery wore a toupee for each and every one? That is something that not a lot of people know. And I think it's very interesting to find out. So there's that.
Oh, wait, I think Captain Jack Sparrow just came in the room.
How did he? Well, that's going to be quite a problem. Somebody better go hide the rum, because he's going to drink it all. And this particular impression is, I think, how I got most of my female companions when I was in high school. Just by pulling out the old Jack Sparrow.
Oh, wait, Bill Compton just came in the room from True Blood.
Well, I've just gotten back from drinking someone's blood. And, Sookie, I see you sitting over there in the corner.
That one's a bit rusty.
Well, Bill, Sean, Jack,
yes.
Max, thank you all for being on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure for each and every one of us to have been here. I think I speak for my comrades. Would you say that's true, gentlemen?
Yes, of course. Right. An absolute pleasure. It's okay.
And, this has been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you, Max.
Of course. Thank you, Katie.